Hello out there.
Yes, hello out there, everyone, and welcome back to None But the Brave, a presentation of Evergreen Podcasts. I am Hal Schwartz, and if you're a regular listener to our show, you know I normally introduce my great buddy Flynn McClain now, my fantastic partner. Unfortunately, Flynn is sick this week, and we're going to do something a little different tonight because we recorded an interview with Kirk Minahan from Barstool discussing the U.S. leg of the 2014 High Hopes Tour. And the plan was that Flynn and I would record an opening focusing on the shows that we didn't discuss with Kirk. So since Flynn is unavailable and we don't want to delay what we think is a pretty entertaining interview with Kirk, we're just going to go ahead and run it, and we'll come back to the other U.S. states as part of our next episode. So what's going to follow now is Flynn introducing Kirk, and things will proceed from there.
Our guest tonight is the host of his own Kirk Minahan show on Barstool. He's also now joined forces with Dave Portnoy and Ryan Whitney to create a new show for Barstool called The Unnamed Show. Kirk Minahan, welcome back to the podcast.
Yes, yes, yes. My very favorite podcast in the world.
Oh, thank you very much. That means a lot.
Well, I'm at the Kirk Minahan show, but yes, number the brave. I'm always happy to. Oh, it's been I think since last year. Yeah, a lot has been going on, including the next show I had lined up, which has been delayed 76 times. The show in Mohegan, which I know we'll talk about another Mohegan show here soon. So yeah, I'm looking forward to more Bruce shows here very soon, which is a good thing.
Now, to go back to your appearance on our show last year, you kind of guaranteed us that Tracks 2 was coming, and you said there was going to be a hashtag Kirk was right. Well, mm-hmm. You know, I know it's not your fault, but you weren't right for the.
Did anybody release Tracks 2? Did I Lover Boys? Did anybody release Tracks 2 out there somewhere? Tone Loke? Probably not. No, that was probably wishful. I know you guys have been longing that forever. Same. I hope and hope and hope and hope and hope, and it feels like something should come out this year, 40th anniversary of something. I can't remember what.
Born in the USA.
There should be something released, but no more guarantees. No. Kirk was wrong. It doesn't happen often.
It does not.
Yeah, it happened.
Well, let's get back into the High Hopes Tour. And thank you very much for suggesting the topic. We appreciate it. Now, I forget, which shows did you see on the U.S. leg?
So I was in Raleigh, Pittsburgh, Albany, and then the two final shows on the tour Connecticut.
So tell us what you felt seeing these shows first starting in Pittsburgh. As we were talking about with Ted and with Jason last time for the international shows, the entire year of 2014 was just pretty damn wild.
Yeah, so I listened to that. And what those guys were articulating was exactly what I was feeling as a fan, and kind of a spillover really from the sort of the end of the 2012 tour, which was that sort of everything was in play. I remember going to see him, you know, in Vernon Downs, in these places where the set lists were getting increasingly wild. So, you know, you went in there not knowing anything. You had an idea, you know, six or eight songs, but it was one of those things where you went in and thought, you know, everything was in play, sort of these dream songs that you am I ever going to hear this song? But you go in thinking, there's a chance here tonight. So, yeah, I went in there, and Pittsburgh's a great Springsteen town. I've seen him there. This is my third time seeing him there. So I was ready for a hot show for sure.
You look at the first four songs. It was the debut of Clamp Down, the Clash cover, Stand On It in the fourth spot, followed by Seven Nights to Rock in half an hour of the show. What was that like?
If I'm remembering this Seven Nights to Rock correctly, I think I am. This was the one where Patty actually sang verses about like guys. She was talking about like John and Paul and Tom, I think. So it was sort of that. It was definitely not the cleanest version of it, but it was fun. And yeah, you're sort of in this thing where I went in, and I'm with you guys. I actually agree with you guys. I remember one of your guests last week sort of didn't agree, but I like it best when he has a story and an album and some, you know, whether it's Magic or even this last tour where there's sort of a story, a narrative thread. This one I was fine with. Like the weather was getting warmer. Everyone was in a good mood, and it was just screw it. Like, let's just play everything. So like the Stand On It in the four spot in the Seven Nights to Rock, like make a lot of sense. Like, not really, but who cares? So it was kind of a good, sloppy, enjoyable first, like maybe hour or so. I'm looking at the set list here now, you know, and then things kind of got to normal a little bit. And then it got, you know, I think I Want to Be With You was the debut at that point. That was like the 9 or 10 spot. So at that point, you're thinking sort of everything's in play, back in your arms after that. And then I have to say, by the standard of this tour, it was kind of static or kind of nothing. I don't think anything insane after that, if I'm remembering correctly.
Well, before we get to that part,
yeah, yeah.
I want to ask about Clampdown.
Oh, yeah.
It was the first time they had done it. Obviously, Morello had put a bug in Bruce's ear. I was not really into that song. I wasn't familiar with it beforehand. Were you? And then how did it go over in the arena?
Classic. So my buddy I was with and I sort of figured out, like, we're now in the, you know, phone Google search lyrics era. So in the middle, we kind of realized, oh, shit, this is what this song is. I knew it, kind of. I have to admit, I'm not as big a Clash fan as maybe I should be. But I liked it. I liked it live. And then going back over the years listening to it, I liked that version sort of more and more. I think it sounds pretty good with those guys. Yeah. And the audience, I think, was, you know how it is with shows like that, where I always feel like that opening song, he can kind of play whatever. Like, the crowd is going to respond to it. And that one, I think 90% of the audience was the same as I was, kind of, what is this, and realized what it was. But, like, it got a pretty good reaction.
Well, certainly going into Badlands, if he lost anybody, he was getting them right back.
Yeah, that's true. It was a smart move going to that. And then, yeah, whenever you play that early, the crowd was ready to go. As I recall, it was a good crowd. They were definitely into it, and he sounded great. And I thought the band sounded, you know, Seven Nights of Rock was a mess, but I thought the band sounded great. I remember that night leaving thinking, Jesus, they sound great.
Sometimes when things aren't so smooth, that's when you get the loosest and more fun moments. I think he was talking about in those three songs, Johnny 99, Stand On, and Seven Nights, you got a rockabilly thing going. And I think he really played that up at that point.
For sure. Definitely. And then, then it kind of slowed down. Like I said, I think it was, I'm looking at it now. Yeah. I Want to Be With You in the Back in Your Arms. And I thought Back in Your Arms was their much better versions. That was a sign, I'm pretty sure. And like, good version. I hadn't heard it maybe in the last couple of years. I'm not sure if I heard it in 2012. So it was always good to hear that. And you're kind of at the point now, like I said, where you're watching it. And I always think this is wild with Springsteen. This is, I went with somebody who had never been before, which is always kind of an interesting perspective too, because you walk out and, you know, he says, geez, I didn't hear, you know, My Hometown. I didn't hear I'm On Fire. I didn't hear Tunnel of Love. And it's like, yeah, that you're not, there are shows where you're probably not going to get, I don't know, 12 of his 13, 14 top 10 hits. It's just not going to happen.
As the show continued, you're right, it did settle into a little bit more of a standard pattern with Wrecking Ball, The Promised Land, Youngstown, Lonesome Day, Mary's Place. So that was all pretty straightforward. But then when you got to the encores here, it really wasn't straightforward. He sat down and he played The Promise, which is always great and has been rare over the years. And then there was the pairing talking about theme of The Wall into Born in the USA. And we're going to talk about this also later on because it repeats at other shows. But to me, that was one of the most stunning pairings he's ever done.
Yeah, I wish it was part of the show every night, it would be great. I mean, if Born in the USA, I think, should be played every night. But I hadn't heard The Promise live since Staples Center, that set in 99. I heard it then. So yeah, when he sat down at the piano, you're kind of thinking, well, what are we going to get here? And yep, Promise. And I thought The Wall, I think The Wall is a great song. And I think, right, pairing with Born in the USA is a great combination. And then Joe comes out, and then we're in Pittsburgh. So you get, you know, you have Light of Day, which I know they sound checked, into a whole bunch of stuff. So yeah, it was I think it was like 8 or 9 on my glasses. Actually, yeah, it was probably a 7 or 8 song encore, maybe more. But yeah, The Promise into The Wall into Born in the USA was unbelievable.
And then interestingly enough, Frankie Fell in Love. That seems to be, I think, Bruce said it's Mrs. Grushecki. This is one of Mrs. Grushecki's favorite songs off that album.
Yeah. I will say you could even tell at that point, I felt that night, I remember feeling this, that the stuff from High Hopes was not resonating particularly strongly, I thought, with the audience that much. And because I also think, you know, I think there's such anticipation, like, what are we going to get? And then you get a song like that, which is a fine song, but there's kind of that, okay, we're waiting for something else in the encore. Just felt like a time killer.
Okay, I guess there were only 4 songs off the High Hopes album.
Right, not much
done
played
at this show.
Yeah, not much played. Right.
Not much at all.
And I kind of got the sense that people were, you know, and you could tell that Bruce knew that too as a tour, as a show, you know, fewer and fewer songs from. It's a wild tour, and it just felt like he just felt like going out and playing a bunch of random songs. Like, he wasn't touring behind this record.
Right.
I mean, not particularly. It just felt like an excuse to go out and do, you know, kind of a mini tour, which I think, which I thought was great, like sort of unusual for him. And just, you know, like every show you went in knowing like you're going to get a great, crazy set list.
And moving on to Raleigh, which was the very next show, this one actually on paper doesn't seem quite as bold as some of the other set lists from this year. What did you think of the Raleigh show?
It was a good show. I was saying, I think before we started, I was saying the Flint. So I with my schedule at the time on the radio, I was kind of figuring out to take a few days off. So I was either going to do Charlotte and Pittsburgh or Pittsburgh and Raleigh. I chose the latter one. And you were mentioning your bucket list songs. He opened Charlotte with what you guys, I'm sure, will talk about it with Iceman, which was, to me, once I saw, I remember seeing it and thinking, this is great, but I was heartbroken that I wasn't going to see that. And I am very confident that I'm never going to see that song live in my entire life. I'm going to guess on this leg of the tour, I'm not going to hear Iceman. I'm just going to take a guess.
Sadly, we are forced to agree. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, so he's played, what, Flint three times? Is that right? In the last whatever.
Three times. It was three, the Tower.
Yeah. Paris? And, no, was that
my Paris, guess? Yeah. Tower, Paris, and Charlotte. Right. Yeah.
So, yeah, whiffed on. Raleigh was, you know, was a good show. Again, like by the standard that we're going to talk about these later shows, not as crazy, but I enjoyed it. Like good crowd. I'm trying to think of anything.
Well, the thing about that show is that Jessica, she was attending Duke at the time. And so the entire there was a pit, and I think there was actually a pit before the pit.
Yes. And that people inner we know pit, went in, and there was a pit blocked off in front of the traditional pit.
Yeah, right, they're all in the front row, her and all her friends, I believe.
Yes,
right?
Exactly. Yeah. It was all so I got the feeling that Bruce was kind of playing to her and her friends, and it seems like when he's trying to do that, he goes a little more conservative in his set list choices. Mm-hmm. And this is an obvious example. Obviously, he was going to highlight some Patty songs. You got Brilliant Disguise,
right?
And then you did get Pretty Flamingo, where he did talk about meeting Patty and such. A little different than back in '75. Yeah.
And I think they soundchecked Human Touch that night, which would obviously be her as well.
They did.
Yeah, they did. Yeah. And that would have been what I would consider a much more interesting song than Brilliant Disguise.
Definitely. Though I like the Atlantic City Brilliant Disguise. I kind of like that combination. That was that night. Those are two of my favorites. But yeah, I would definitely swap out Human Touch for sure. Yeah. But yeah, so Patty was there with all, she was, right. They had the whole front there. And you're right. Like, it was sort of a, It was nothing. When you look at the set list, I remember watching, being there, nothing jumps out as a super crazy, memorable moment, like a perfectly good show, had a good time, and left kind of thinking, oh, maybe this tour is starting to turn to be completely wrong. But this is turning into sort of a semi-standard tour. Like, it's kind of trying to figure out what it is. But yeah, no, I would say of the three, I've talked about here, the five I was at, this is probably the one that was, I probably liked the least. It was fine, but yeah, I have no great memories about it.
Yeah, exactly. Growing up was rare at the time. And as I said, pretty Flamingo, but otherwise, yeah, nothing too exciting in the set list.
And it makes sense because I guess with Jessica and her friends there, Iceman, stuff like that, that was not going to appeal to that particular audience.
No, though I'm guessing these college kids are not clamoring for, you know, Atlantic City and Johnny 99. Like, it's probably not tales that these college, you know, I mean, I wonder when she brings her friends to these shows, like, these college kids don't know any Bruce Springsteen songs. This guy's going to be, you know, so I mean, just why not just go for it? But yeah, I mean, it was like a B- by my standard Springsteen show. If you rank them all, it'd be somewhere probably toward the bottom half.
All right, well, let's move on to the three shows we all saw at the tail end of the tour, beginning in Albany, May 13, 2014. Now, when we talk about wild shows, this is about as wild as I think I've seen. Not the best show, to be sure, but an incredibly crazy set list from the moment it started that night in Albany. Flynn, what did you take away from the opening of the Albany show?
Well, actually, it's funny. I disagree with you that it was, I mean, it was wild. It was a wild set list. But I think as a narrative or an emotional arc of a show, I thought this was the best one I saw.
Oh, you mean the 2014?
Yeah. in 2014.
Yeah, I would agree. This is the best of the three shows I saw in 2014.
Totally agree. I hate to agree.
Yeah, but it was, you had some wild stuff. Treat Her Right, where that girl jumped up on stage with
them. That was crazy.
Save the Last Dance for Me and Kingdom of Days Acoustic. Those were the tour debuts. And then you had Better Day, Seaside Bar Song, and Mary's Place. So I thought, but those worked in sequence very well. I thought this was a very good show. As I said, definitely the best of 2014 for me.
I did not expect walking into the arena that night that I was going to get Treat Her Right into Something in Tonight, into Something in the Night, and to Save the Last Dance for Me. And Something in the Night is something I've been chasing forever. I've only heard it once on the Devils and Dust tour in Connecticut, so I never heard it with the band.
Oh, wow.
And after Treat Her Right, I did not expect to hear Something in the Night. It just felt, and it was not on the set list. Like, I think forgetting Something in the Night, which is one of my favorite songs. Was there seven cover songs? Six cover?
Well, there's Don't Change.
Right.
Treat Her Right.
Save the Last Dance for Me.
Right.
Staying Alive.
Staying Alive, yeah.
Shout. So, yeah, there were five?
About five.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, it's sort of kind of a crazy, you know. Yeah, I mean, obviously, High Hopes too would be a cover song. So,
oh, good point.
Six.
I forget about that.
You have six cover songs that night, but they were all. Save the Last Dance for Me was great, and I thought Kingdom of Days was a real highlight. Also, that's like a forgotten. Again, you'll never hear it again. It's not on a great album, but it was sort of this acoustic great version.
Oh, it was beautiful.
Great! Just a wild. I thought it was a wild show. I went in. Like I said, off of Raleigh, kind of thinking, okay. And then once Don't Change started, which I love, we were kind of off to the races. But I would agree. I think this was the high point of this tour.
And he really went with the crowd that night. I'm actually looking at the set list right now. After Treat Her Right on the set list was Hunter of Invisible Game and then Into Heaven's Wall. Now, neither of those were played. And they were both lesser known songs off of High Hopes, of course. Clearly doing Something in the Night, and then followed it by that Save the Last Dance to Me, which was a request. A girl in the audience asked him to dance with her mother.
Her mom, right.
Yeah, he really altered the show midstream there, and it really kicked it into a much higher gear.
Because he had kind of a wild soundcheck. Well, I guess not. He soundchecked All or Nothing at All, which I think he played the show before in Houston, which I wouldn't have minded hearing with the band. I thought it was a pretty good version of the one in Houston, actually. But yeah, you could tell like he went totally off the set list at that point. And I did not need to hear Hunter of Invisible Game. I didn't need to watch that video again. I don't need to hear that. It's a fine song, but yeah, I was okay without it.
To go back to Hal's question though, talking about the start of the show, mm-hmm. I thought it started in high gear with Don't Change, as you mentioned, and then going into My Love, No Surrender, and then a surprisingly strong This Is Your Sword. I was not expecting it to be that good, and it worked so well coming after No Surrender and then into Badlands.
And even that was great. And even, you know, when the sign went up for Mary's Place, I was like, oh Jesus, here we go. And it was a much, like, it's been the last much better, stripped down, not crazy. Into Staying Alive, which I liked when he played it the beginning of the tour, and I kind of like that song. I like that version of that song. I think it's a great song. I think Barry Gibb is like one of the great underrated songwriters of all time. But I thought it was a great version. I enjoyed it.
Same here. I like that song, period, and it's fun, and he had a good time with it. Didn't have strings for this one like he did down in Australia,
right.
But
right.
it was still pretty darn good.
I enjoyed it too, though I didn't need to see it again a couple of nights later.
That's true.
But we'll get to that.
Yep.
Before we move on to Mohegan, let's talk about the encores in Albany. Now, we got the Wall, Born in the USA pairing, which was phenomenal. And then the end, not an unusual set of songs, 10th Avenue, Ramrod, Shout, Thunder Road. But he had really tapped into something that night. I remember the Ramrod in particular was off the charts in terms of the energy. Do you guys remember that?
I don't know if I remember that or not. I remember that I just was probably hyper-focused and still remember that pairing that started off. So I don't remember the Ramrod version of it. But yeah, I mean, I remember the Wall and the Born in the USA sounding great. Born in the USA was not on the set list either that night.
I don't think it was. The other thing about the Encores was the Thunder Road was full band, which a lot of those shows in 2014, he ended with the acoustic version. This is also goes to what I was talking to, because the Thunder Road being full band had the ending capped on a much higher energy note than when he was ending with the acoustic songs, which also worked great, but it was just a totally different feel.
This is Krista Makes, guitarist and vocalist for Less Than Jake, and host of Krista Makes a Podcast, a songwriting podcast where every week I'm joined by an amazing guest to break down the writing, recording, and release of one iconic song from their career. In our giant evergreen back catalog of episodes, we've had rock legends such as Dee Snider and Huey Lewis, punk rock favorites like Mark Hoppus, Fat Mike, and Brett Gurewitz, and up-and-coming artists of today such as Liz Stokes of the Beths and Genesis Owusu. We've had guests from all genres and styles of music, and I guarantee that if you peruse our back catalog, you'll see several episodes that'll make you say, "Man, I gotta hear that." Whether you're a fan of music or a creator of music yourself, you'll take away a whole new appreciation for the songs you know and love. Krista Makes a Podcast is available for free on all the places you could possibly listen to podcasts, and new episodes come out every Monday.
All right, well, let's move on to Mohegan, which was basically like a Springsteen convention weekend in Connecticut. And literally, I mean, Flynn, how many people did we know in that building? The place holds about, I think, 10,000 for a concert. We must have known like 5 to 10% of the building.
At least. At least we knew a lot of people in the pit. And Bruce knew that people were coming in from all over. And so, he started off those two nights with a sound check that included the Promise version of Racing in the Street, Seven Angels, which has never been played, Price You Pay, and gave it a name, which I would not put on my top 10 songs that I was dying to hear, but he sound checked it but didn't play it.
We heard that sound check.
Dumb question. Did he? I think the answer is no, but you guys know better than me. He did not play Gave It a Name on Devils and Dust, did he?
Never played it.
No, never played, right? That feels like that would have been a throwaway opener in one of the Devils and Dust shows. But yeah, I was not on my top 100 list to want to hear, but if he played, it would have been great. Yeah. Big night for you, though, Hal. I think you got Jesse James that night, right?
How to prove it.
Well, yes, that was the most jarring transition. That was the most jarring transition I think we've ever experienced.
Well, hell, yes, I remember. I didn't know you, obviously, but that sign you had up for Jesse James was embarrassing.
Yeah, exactly.
it was massive.
And I was dressed in character.
Yeah. Froggy went to court in the second night. I thought, geez, this guy's lost his mind. I don't know.
Well, let's go back to the opener, though, of Racing in the Street, the Promise version.
Awesome.
But what was really weird.
It was great
to see it, though. Yeah.
It was really weird because it was the music from The Promise.
But the sound, right.
But the lyrics were from the album. It just didn't quite work for me. I was like, come on, Bruce, if you're going to do it, let's go full hog here.
I sometimes wonder if we just remember it more than he does. Like, is he just not do I just care more than he does about this stuff? Or you? I guess the answer is obviously yes.
I believe so. Yes.
yeah. It was because you hear at the beginning, you think, okay, here we go. But yeah, it was a little messy for sure. Yeah.
And then I thought Clamp Down Here really kind of felt like a dud here. I'll be honest.
100%.
You know, I guess people were expecting, a Seven Angels or something along those lines. And then he does this Clash cover that's pretty unknown. And even though it's a small place, I kind of think he lost some people there. And he had to come back and he played three songs, Badlands, Ties, and Two Hearts to keep things going.
I actually, being in the crowd that night, sort of anticipated Badlands in that spot right there. I was just thought like, all right, this seems like a natural Badlands. All right, here we go. Let's get started. Then it gets a little goofy. But yeah, that was a weird, you're right. I remember thinking it didn't feel like it did at the other shows, which where it opened. So yeah, it was definitely a strange placement.
One thing we haven't mentioned yet is that Steve came back. Steve had been absent from this entire leg until these last two shows. And he apparently flew in just to do these two shows. And he was kind of tired. So he was struggling up there on stage a little bit.
Well, one of the things that I felt, and I agree, Badlands should have followed Racing in the Street. This show sort of veered all over the place, and we were joking before, and we'll get to the Prove It All Night and the Jesse James, which is just inexplicable. But it wasn't just there. It sort of went back and forth, and he never really captured a vibe like he had in Albany or like we've seen in some of the other great shows. It certainly had some great setlist nuggets, as we would like to say, but the show itself did not fully work, I think, in the main set. What did you guys think?
Yeah, looking at it now, just it just seems so strange there. And I remember that night thinking, you know, you leave and you think, geez, you have all these great, crazy songs. But you're right, they never found that rhythm. And even the songs that they were excited to hear, it just was in just weird spots. Like, it just felt like It was a mishmash that night. And he couldn't quite, you know, sort of solve the plot sort of the whole night. There were great moments or high moments, but yeah, it seemed like he could never quite figure it out.
Yeah, I thought Through High Hopes was pretty strong. Not exactly adventurous, but it was strong. But then going into three covers in a row, Raise Your Hand, Quarter to Three, and Stayin' Alive. As Hal said, Stayin' Alive is good. Don't really need it to see it twice.
Yeah, did not land there, yeah.
You know, and if you're going to do Quarter to Three, if he's going to do Quarter to Three, let's throw it in the encores, and I think it'll really freshen that up quite a bit.
Yeah, and that went into the sort of the South Side part of it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, Hearts of Stone, Talk to Me, South Side Double Shot, I think Bruce called it.
Yeah, right.
And yeah,
right.
That was when things really picked up, because after those two, you had Price You Pay for the only tour performance. And that was that was good. That was phenomenal.
And I do think Talk to Me is like an underrated, even if you're not a hardcore. I was with my brother that night who's he doesn't know that song. Talk to Me is one of those songs, though, that like everybody likes. Like, it does pick up the energy of the crowd always. Every time I've ever heard it live, it's one of those songs that always lands.
Yeah, even when, especially when Southside does it at his own shows, I feel like it's like,
yes,
all of a sudden things just went up a notch.
Definitely true.
And the American Skin was also very good. Now, it slowed things down a little, but Morello was great on that song. And of course, it was followed by Promised Land, as it usually was. Mm-hmm. And then we got to this segment we were joking about, but it really is indicative of what was going on. Prove It All Night was played, and suddenly, out of nowhere, Prove It ended, and they went right into Jesse James. Now, my feelings, of course, are well known on this, but what did you guys think about Jesse James following Prove It All Night?
It was interesting. I don't even think Prove It ended. I think he segued right from one to the other. He just went boom right into it. And yeah, that was kind of a whiplash there.
Yeah, I mean, I'm with you. Secret Sessions, I think, stinks. Like, it just is not for me. Like, it's fine. I hope people like it. Great. But I remember laughing when I heard that. I remember I actually was eating a pretzel. I actually remember this.
And I was holding it?
No. Just in my hand, I'm saying I had the pretzel. And then Jesse James started. I remember just eating the pretzel and looking at this and thinking, what am I witnessing here? Why is he playing this? There's so many songs I could hear right now. And he's playing Jesse James. I did not understand it, but yeah, it was a Prove It All Night to Jesse James is not going to happen again.
Thankfully.
Thank God.
And I'm a Jesse James fan. I like the Secret Sessions.
Yeah.
But I'm thinking at this point in the tour, second to last night, as Hal said, you had Bruce fans from literally all over the world. Not the song I would have picked, but
it's Bruce, an odd choice to say the least.
Exactly. And then it kind of got normal, Shackled and Drawn, Tom Joad, Nowhere Rising, and then a main set ending of Light of Day. Mm-hmm.
But let me point out that the energy through Joad was really low. Now, you and I, Flynn, we were right near the front, and I could see Bruce's lips. He knew something had gone wrong. Radio Nowhere was not on the set list, and he audible to Radio Nowhere, and that did help bring the energy back up in the building because they play the hell out of that. But yeah, there was a big lull there from the Jesse James on.
Absolutely. And I think he did get it back for the most part with those, with Radio Nowhere, Rising, and then Light of Day, as I said. I thought Light of Day was tremendous.
It was.
It wasn't, you know, the 15-minute thing we got in 99, 2000. So it kind of was more compact.
Then heading into the encores, I thought the encores were spectacular. They started with a double shot of acoustic songs, I'll Work for Your Love, which he was clearly playing for the audience in attendance, and just a fantastic version of Growing Up. And he seemed to really be speaking to the fan base. As we were pointing out, he clearly knew that people had come from all over the place to attend these two shows. And I really felt that pairing was for us, all of the fans. What did you guys agree?
Yeah, I felt like the closest thing, like you guys said earlier, I felt like the closest thing I've ever been to like a Springsteen convention. Like, it did feel that way. And I didn't really know anybody, but I could just see with my brother walking around before the show and going to rest. Like, everybody kind of knew everybody, and he was obviously aware. I think, am I wrong that he jumped on with Dave Marsh before that show? And acknowledge that on Sirius. So you could tell he was very aware. And sometimes I wonder how aware he is of all this stuff. But that night in that second show, he seemed, you know, sort of hyper aware of that.
What I thought was unusual about these encores is that it's eight songs, four are acoustic.
Yeah.
And they were great choices. As you said, Growing Up was amazing. He told a story about the hairdressing salon below his apartment, and I'll Work for Your Love is always a good thing. And then finishing up the show with two acoustic songs.
Second encore was all acoustic, right?
Yeah, Fall Behind and Thunder Road.
Right.
And yeah, that was different. And I thought it was actually very, very good. I thought it was great.
It was. And then we left the arena that night and we went back to our hotels and we got ready for the final night of the tour. And what we didn't know, and this is, I think, one of the most debated shows perhaps that Bruce has ever played in terms of the fan base and the quality. If you look at the set list, it's absolutely insane, batshit crazy.
Bananas.
But there was also stuff that occurred during the show. I think Bruce was very fatigued. And as we've mentioned before on the podcast, this was the last time he ever played back-to-back nights with the E Street Band. Since then, they went to at least one night between the shows. And of course, now in 2024, in most cases, there are two nights between the shows. But for me, this is not really a great show. It was a tremendously fun night, but not one that I think of in the canon. And I've been lucky to see so much. But not one that I think of as, wow, that was really one of the great shows that I've seen. Do you guys agree?
But I don't think, I don't think that can really be your standard for this tour. Maybe I'm not looking at it properly, but I think you know going in that these shows are just going to be wild. Like, is this going to be like the show I saw in Hartford, the reunion tour? No. But like, I knew going in that I had a feeling this was going to be a crazy set list. I didn't know how crazy, but I get what you're saying. And he definitely seemed, you know, worn down. But I never went into these shows thinking I'm going to see one of the greatest Springsteen shows of all time on this tour. It just wasn't my expectation.
Well, this show, in terms of the set list, it really rewarded the longtime fans or the fanatics who traveled all over the world playing stuff from 92 and even disc four of tracks as well as tracks itself. But then, yeah, it kind of hit a wall right around the Ghost of Tom Joad. And had he not hit that wall, had he been able to keep it going, it would have been a legendary show. I think Walk Like a Man was on there, solo piano arrangement indicated.
Right.
That just would have been a holy crap moment for a lot of people. But he just couldn't follow through on what he had done in the first half of the show.
Well, I think also he had written a set list, which was very much in keeping with what we were talking about, that he had written one as sort of a final night for the tour. And it included, as Flynn just mentioned, Walk Like a Man, which was going to open the encores and was clearly thematic for the night. And he had had some other stuff on there, Streets of Fire, Lucky Town, that didn't wind up getting played. And I think besides for his fatigue, which definitely impacted the selections in the second half of the show, I think in the first half, the signs actually sent this show sort of off kilter. And I'm thinking we didn't need Santa Claus.
Definitely not.
You know, and look, he acknowledged a young girl who was cute and all that. But the like the five and six slots were Santa Claus and Seven Angels. And I think it was great to see Seven Angels. But originally on the set list, he had Adam Raised a Cain, Streets of Fire, and those were going to be followed by Frankie. So he had really put some thought into the set list that he wrote, and that's not actually what wound up getting played.
Hello, Tom May here, host of Future Friday. I've spent the last 15 years on the road with my band, The Menzingers, where I've met all kinds of wild and fascinating people. So I started a podcast. On Future Friday, I talk to fellow musicians about the moments that made them, their passions outside of music, and the curiosities that tie us all together. I've also talked to the likes of UFO researchers, magicians, soldiers, and documentary filmmakers, and I'm constantly searching for folks that can shape and change our view of the world. You can check out Future Friday wherever you like.
Let's go back to the beginning where he opened with Roll the Dice and Leap of Faith, two songs from 1992, of course. And then those songs, and I'm going to be curious to hear what we all think of this, were followed by a cover of Van Halen's Jump, which, of course, is on their record 1984. And that was also a very big year for Bruce, as we know. Jump, are we yay or nay?
Well, I've said many times, when I was a 10-year-old, there were two roads I could have gone. I worship Bruce Springsteen and Van Halen. I could have taken a right and gone with Van Halen, or a left. I took a left and went with Bruce. So who knows where I'd be right now? I love 1984. I have the album. I've played it 5 million times. I hated. Was that the Final Four show?
Yes.
Yeah. I hated that version then. I hated that version. They're just certain songs that don't fit. You know, Bruce could probably do a Van Halen song better than John. I just don't like the way that version sounds with them. I just don't like it. I do not like it.
Well, listening back on it, Bruce's voice is just, it doesn't go that high.
Right.
It needs a higher register for it to be done well. And he just didn't have it. I thought it fit really well. Maybe it wasn't the greatest of performance, but I thought thematically it was fine at the Dallas Final Four event. Right. But if he was trying to make a comment about doesn't the WNBA team play in that arena?
The Mystics, yes.
The Mystics are in DC. Actually,
DC, right? Yeah,
one
yeah.
of the few things I know about them.
Right. Right. Yeah.
Does Rebecca Lobo, was she up there or something? I'm trying to think.
There
was something.
14, maybe. I don't know.
Who knows? But I mean, if he was doing that, that's quite a stretch.
Quite a reach there, and just didn't quite work. If he had gone into, say, Lucky Town or Better Days there, I probably would have lost my brain right there, and so would have Al.
And I like the 1-2 punch to start. Like, I had no I thought that was pretty
fun. It was great.
Yeah, I was excited. You know, those are songs you almost never hear, so I even liked the whole at the beginning. Did you lose your money? I was fine. That was good. That was a good time. Like, I'm like, all right, here we go. And then Jump, and it kind of, everyone knows the song, of course, but I thought it definitely kind of slowed the audience down for a bit. He got him back, but yeah.
Yeah,
Frankie, I think they were stunned. I think the audience was like, what the hell is going on here?
True.
Well, I think they were, they, I thought, I felt they were into it. Maybe I'm wrong. Yeah. Maybe I'm just reaching back and misremembering or whatever. But I thought he got him back with Frankie. And and then I thought Seven Angels and Don't Look Back were great.
Awesome. Yeah.
They were great.
Yes. What's Santa, again, not needed.
The Santa Claus was just, I don't think it worked. Did it work in the building?
No.
No, it was confusing. It was May. It was just, it didn't make no sense. It was like, what the hell's going on? Why are you doing this? Again, I'm sitting there saying, you know, I know there's only so many songs left on this tour. Why are you, but then, to your point, you go Seven Angels, Don't Look Back, Darkness, back to back to back. And then, you know, we're all good.
That's true. And then I kind of feel like he just gave everybody a solo there. High Hopes, Youngstown, Murder Incorporated. I feel like he pulled out Murder just to give Steve a solo, just one of his best solos of the last 25 years.
Right.
And anyway,
Adam Raised a Cain, you know, which is one of my favorites. So it's always good to hear that.
Yeah, we had four guitars going off on that one.
That is true. Everyone was there.
Yeah, that was a hot stretch. The Murder Inc., Johnny 99, Cadillac Ranch, I'm a Rocker, Loose Ends. And then I think if I remember properly, it was right during those songs, Cadillac Ranch, I'm a Rocker, thereabouts, where you could see he was really starting to have energy issues, I think is the fair way of putting it.
He hit a wall. And I'm Kirk, you're a runner. I don't know if you've done a marathon.
I have, yeah.
You've hit a wall.
It's really not pretty. I've hit the wall hard. It is not pleasant.
It's not fun at all. And that's what happened here. And that last, looks like the last hour of the show, I'm sure he was working really hard because he didn't have much in the tank at that point.
Yeah, and the set list obviously shows that. Like, it was definitely, you know, pretty standard, and then we were kind of done at that point. But all the way through Loose Ends,
yep,
like everything was in play. Every song in the catalog. I mean, when you're playing Santa Claus Coming to Town and Seven Angels at the same show,
back to back,
everything's a possibility.
Yeah, it's interesting that he did Jungle Land, because that was a song that
it
allowed him to rest, because there's that.
Yeah, he didn't move much, and there's a long solo.
Sax solo, right?
Yeah, that legendary solo goes on for like 3 minutes, so he was able to relax. And he did not sound very good on Dream Baby Dream. He was really sucking wind on that one.
So you guys, with those three shows, you would go Albany, Mohegan Night. Would you go Night Two still over Night One, though, just because of the set list?
Definitely.
I would as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That Albany was definitely the highlight of that tour for me. But I enjoyed the Virginia Beach show that I saw in April a lot as well. That was, had some pretty unique stuff in there.
And I did really enjoy both Mohegan shows as they were happening. The second night in particular, I mean, it did open with 7 straight tour debuts. When are we going to see that again?
Well, Jump really wasn't a tour debut. I know Bruce Bays has it as a tour debut.
That's true.
But they played
I'm looking at Bruce Bays now. Yeah,
yeah,
they
played it.
They don't consider the Dallas show as part of the tour. All right.
Well, yes. Disagree with Bruce Bays on that one.
It was a very interesting evening. There are a lot of people, because of the wildness of the set and all the tour premieres, who get upset when we leave this one out of our discussions about the top tier shows. But there was just something a little off on this night. And I think his physical issues definitely had something to do with it. But I just wish there have been two shows, and I think both nights he had physical issues, so it's probably not a coincidence. There have been two shows that we've seen. Kirk, were you at the Labor Day show in Philly in 2012?
I was not.
Yeah, because that was another show where he had written out a handwritten set list that really was thought out with all sorts of cool stuff. And there, too, it was very, very hot that night.
And humid.
And humid, yeah. And he also, I think, hit a wall in that show. And he varied tremendously off the handwritten set list and went to more standard material, but you can't take anything away from it. I mean, it was a tremendously fun weekend.
Yeah, and I love the tour. Like, I look back very, that's why I sent you that message. I look back fondly on this weird sort of almost parentheses in his tour career, where he just kind of for a few months said, let's just go do this before, you know, doing the river there a couple of years later. This is something when I look back at these set lists, I mean, obviously, we're never going to see anything close to this ever again. Sad to say, but just the way it is.
Yeah, it was a wild 4 or 5 months in there with these shows. And, you know, we talk about whether a show has a narrative or an emotional arc or whatever. These shows didn't have it, really didn't need it for the most part. It was fun. If you wanted the narrative arc, go back to Wrecking Ball, or you look ahead to the river, or now, or 2023-24. But these were just anything goes, and it was a lot of fun. And I put together some playlists from this tour, and it's amazing just how many different songs he did. I don't know. I don't have the count. It must be at least 100.
Has to be. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there was just wild variety. And, you know, it's like Kirk was saying. I mean, some of the choices you do sort of scratch your head. You know, Jesse James on this Springsteen convention weekend, when there were songs off The River or Darkness, you know, that people want to hear, other cooler songs off Tracks that I'm sure we would want to hear. But you just have to appreciate the sort of craziness that was going on here. And as Kirk says, we're definitely not going to see again.
I almost pair it in a weird way. They're obviously two totally different tours, but by the end of the Devils and Dust tour, when things were getting just sort of crazy, you know, I remember looking at Backstreets the next day at some of these shows, and I was like, he's playing this song, he's playing that song, you know, sort of that end of the tour thing, which, you know, again, I don't know. I'm optimistic. I think maybe he'll revert to some level of that coming forward in the next few months. Maybe I'll be wrong. But yeah, like great memories of this tour. Do I listen to the album much? I do not, but that's okay. Like, it was a good tour.
Yeah, album is so odds and sods, as I said in the last episode. And,
right, slapped together, yeah.
I mean, you know, you had the four songs with Morello, and then you had songs from The Rising and Magic that just didn't fit in. And hey, it's tracks two, disc five.
True. See,
if you look at it that way, it's a lot better.
I told you it'd be released. It just happened to be 10 years ago.
Yeah. Well, it was between 2005 and 2014.
Exactly.
The one thing I'll say in regards to the Devils and Dust tour, I do think even at the end, he was a little bit more locked into his narrative structure. Of course, he was playing songs off the Devils and Dust album all the way till the end. This, he definitely, you're right what you said at the beginning. You know, he put out this record. I think he just wanted to have some material out. It's interesting as we're talking in 2024, because of course, as he heads into this year, we've now been, 3.5 years since Letter to You came out. This, in the past, would have definitely been a spot where he would have released something prior to touring. But now I think he's just going with what he's already put together. And the album here in 2014, it just sort of functioned as to have something out there to play a couple of these songs. And you know, some of them were interesting and some of them I think were less so. I would have liked to have seen Hunter of Invisible Game with the one time. I will say that.
Yeah. I mean, everything for one off for me is always worth it. Like, even if it's, I'd rather hear a one off than something I like that I just like. You know, yeah, I'd be fine with that trade off. I get that.
Yeah. I would rather hear something unusual. I mean, as we were talking about the Cardiff release. I'd rather hear a sloppy TV movie than a note perfect out in the street. I'm going to hear something new, hear something different. And that's what he gave us in 2014.
So, Kirk, we thank you so much again for joining us. And we thank you for all the support of our show. It means the world to us. It's really awesome. And you're welcome on anytime.
Thanks, guys. Hopefully I'll see you in the next few months on the road out there somewhere. I'll be in Albany and Mohegan. So hopefully I'll catch up with you guys.
I think I'll be at one of those two. I'm not sure which one yet.
Yeah, I won't, but hopefully later in the year.
There you go.
Hope to see you.
All right.
Thank you again.
Thanks, guys.
Once again, that was Kirk Minahan. And from there, Flynn and I were going to just briefly discuss the fact that the second Mohegan show was pulled from circulation after it was released originally as part of the official live series. To make a long story short, in 2014, the shows were released by Live Nation. After that, Bruce then made a deal with Nugs. They transferred everything over. But when that happened, Mohegan 2 was not put up on Nugs. It's never been available for sale there. And speculation is from us, and I think pretty much from everyone, that at some point Bruce or his people had listened to that show and they decided that the second half of the show, he sounded pretty ragged. So they decided just to take it from circulation. I would say everything should be out. Obviously, that one was already out, so I don't know what the point of that was, and hopefully at some point they will return it, but I wouldn't bet on that. The other thing I want to tell you is about our next couple of episodes. We expect there's going to be an archive release for March prior to the tour. If that happens, we're going to do a review show, and now we'll probably add the other High Hopes material to that. And then in mid-March, we're going to do a show looking at the 25th anniversary of the reunion era beginning, because of course, on March 18th, 1999, they kicked things off in Asbury. And as hard as it is to believe, it's been 25 years. It's just pretty mind blowing. So with that, I'll wrap things up. Our usual spiel, check out our Patreon offerings, patreon.com/MBTB podcast. On Twitter, we're at MBTB podcast. I'm Hal Schwartz, and for Flynn McLean, we'll see you further on up the road.
Thank you so much. We'll be seeing you.
Hey, what's up? This is Blake Weiland. I'm the host of the Tone Mob Podcast. It's a show where I interview guitar people about guitar stuff. We talk about their pedals, their amps, their accessories, their preferences, all that stuff, as well as a healthy dose of whatever comes up. Topics have ranged from aliens to addiction and anywhere in between. Oh yeah, and pizza. We're definitely going to be talking about pizza. So get the show wherever you're listening to this podcast at. Just search The Tone Mob in your search bar and it will pop right up. Come join us. We're having a lot of fun. Thanks for checking it out.